apartment almost burned down, and she wound up in the hospital with smoke inhalation. I went to see her in the hospital, and that's when reality slapped me in the face. When you love somebody, set them free. And I just had to let her go. She went back to her parents, but I can still see her in the songs we sang together. And the greatest thing she taught me, that love is love reflected. So much to be dealt with when you fall, and I fell hard, and I fell heavy, and I fell so in love. Was it from songs, from my Italian family, from heaven or hell? I'm a breeder, been married twice. They say never trust a rock musician. We can write songs about love, but we're not allowed to be in love. Oh yeah, that's right. I fell in love with you from the side of the stage, surrounded by other women. Your significant other would say if she were honest, but they don't think that. You get married, and sometimes you fall from God's grace. You're sitting there saying to them, yeah, but sweetheart, you see the girls screaming at me every night. I don't sleep with them. I just make love to them through my music. And that stage is my mistress. Why are you angry at me? And actually, I liked it. When I was younger and easily impressed, I watched my heroes and I was enticed by that. The crowds, the adulation, the sexuality, and the girls that loved rock guys. Certainly wasn't the money. You know, guys in rock bands aren't the only devils. Wives can be just as bad. I've known some wives that cheated on the guys while they were on tour, and the husbands never knew it. And they said I should be wearing the genital cuff. I came up with a second album title, Get Your Wings, after reading a book on the Hell's Angels. Getting your wings is a Hell's Angels thing. If you give a girl head when she has a period, you are definitely one of the guys. And my friend, you've got your wings. The album came out in March 1974, and we were on the road again. We toured like Gypsy Possessed. We opened for Mott the Hoople, Black Sabbath, Blue Oyster Cult, The Guess Who, and Kiss. We were on tour continually and endlessly. We made as little as $500 a night in places where they didn't know us and almost $4,000 where they did. Get Your Wings was bubbling in the Hot 100, and as a result of our never-ending road juggernaut, it got us our first gold record the following year. That spring, we opened for Hawkwind, the Brit sci-fi rockers, at Alex Cooley's Electric Ballroom in Atlanta. Every night, there'd be a girl in the front row, very scantily clad, silver glitter spray all over her body and little nipple cups. And really hot. Stone gorgeous. She was the glitter queen, and she came to every show we ever played in Atlanta. We did a great show at Cooley's one night. I was up in the dressing room afterward. The backstage was full of people, along with a couple of girls in the dressing room, naked. My old childhood friend, Ray, was there. He was working his ass off with the band and had a bag of blow. Ray had the greatest connections. The red Lebanese hash with a camel embossed on the bag, same as the stuff he'd scored for Led Zeppelin. Oh, how they loved that shit. One of my bandmates took a look at the glitter queen, and he was gone. She disappeared, and so did he. I think she swallowed him up a couple of times. The girl standing there in front of me was hot, not to mention very ambidextrous. She could bend over backward, my kind of girl, and she had a flat head where I could rest my beer. A little known quality in those who bend. Later, Ray had the same girl in the toilet stall. She's standing on her head with her feet up against the wall, and he's pretending to pour Jack Daniels into her jiny, but actually pouring it into a shot glass and sticking the shot glass into her kuha and drinking out of it with a straw. When Ray was done, he poured Jack on his schwanz, because he thought it would kill the herpes he was about to get. One snort leads to another, and pretty soon it's 2 hours later. My bandmate, who will remain nameless, is hiding backstage, ramming the glitter queen with the silver paint all over her body while we're getting gacked to the nines on blow, which we called Krell, in the dressing room. Motley Crue says they coined that term for coke in the 80s after the Krell, the people who lived on the Forbidden Planet. Hey, where were you? I inquire when said bandmate returns. But when he gets close enough, we know. We all fall down laughing because his face and shirt are covered with silver glitter paint. There's silver paint in his hair, glitter all over his mouth. His penis looks like the Tin Man. And up behind him comes the glitter queen herself with all the silver paint rubbed off her breasts and her pussy. Oh, man. We'd come off stage just shy of midnight. They'd shoot everybody out of the club and closed up. By now, it's 3 a.m. I go downstairs, and I can't get out, so I run back up. Oh, my God, you guys, we're chained in. There are chains across every door. What were we going to do? Locked in with a pile of blow, Jack Daniels, and a bunch of hot, naked chicks. The only way to get out was to force open the door a crack, and then you could climb up and over, which I did. I got out, made a phone call to Alex Cooley, and it took an hour before anybody came. For the fifth time. I know, we were younger then. Upon returning to the hotel, I recited my nightly prayer. Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. You keep my soul, I know it's taken. Hope you don't mind if I stab my bacon. All these girls had to do was look on the back of the album, see what the tour manager's name was, and if you're in Chicago, call up every hotel that Aerosmith might be staying at, which would whittle it down to maybe four, call the front desk and say, I'm looking for Kelly, he's my cousin, he'll be coming with Aerosmith. It took the fans 20 years to get hip to this, and me 25 years to figure it out. That is assuming, and it's quite a lot to assume, that the tour manager would have even been available or would have given a fuck about my aching needs. Tour managers, I found out later, had other things on their mind, such as hobnobbing all night long with people they knew from the last time we'd played there, people with primo blow. So many nights I went to sleep dreaming that two gorgeous, nasty twins were going to knock on my door, cover me in rose petals, and perform an after-midnight rectal examination. But no way. They never arrived. Perhaps they didn't know I sometimes used the name I.K. Malone when I checked in. The chick at the front desk had a field day with that. I'll be right up, she would say. You get into a hotel elevator in a place you played the night before, and you know the last fucking person you want to meet is someone going, Oh my God, it's you, in that Valley Girl accent. This person in the Hyatt House elevator is having a God experience and you haven't had coffee yet. By the time you're through your 15th or 20th person having a religious experience, you wish you were a gasket salesman from Omaha. You get home that night, the next day you wake up, it's your day off, and step outside and what do you see but the 300-pound guy in sweatpants you'd run into in the elevator the day before. He's camped outside your door and he's drying his clothes on your lawn. Perfect. Chapter 7. Noise in the Attic. Snow Days. The buzz that you're getting from the crack don't last. I'd rather be ODing in the crack of her ass. Steven Tyler and Joe Perry. Fever. Those were the days when AIDS was not yet in the world. You couldn't die from getting late. Those were different days. And cocaine? Doctors said it was not addictive. It was habituating. They didn't know at the time that the drug would eventually take a sharp turn after a certain day. Blow, once the life of the party, became the stuff of fear and loathing, the source of devious and secretive behavior, and the mother of all lies. What, me? No, I don't have any. Sorry, ran out. Bummer, man. Nope. Hey, I gotta go to the bathroom. And that's where the rock and roll bathroom came from. That's when people started keeping stuff in two pockets. You had your courtesy bindle you'd share, so people didn't do too much, and you had your main stash in your sock, and thus sin and doubt entered our happy world. Fame derails people, not to mention the drugs. But drugs were nothing new to me. I had a lot of practice with drugs. I'd been getting high since I was 16. I was getting high all the time back then. It was part of my education. Ray and I would set our alarm for 4 o'clock, drop acid, go back to sleep, and then wake up at 5:30 or 6 just slamming. It really started before that with speed, so much so that I wrote a poem. Set your alarm. It'll do you no harm to get off while you're asleep. You'll get off so fast, with the next hit you blast, you'll do in a day what you could in a week. With speed, your brain knew you took it and you were up. But acid, you could take it and go back to sleep. We'd get up and go to high school tripping our brains out. I used to smoke pot and listen to the Beatles, trying to decipher their lyrics. With grass, you could read between the lines. With acid, there was nothing but between the lines. Both essential talents of the times. Norwegian wood. Now what could that possibly mean? Today, it would be as obvious as the balls on a tall dog. Smoking pot was so much better than drinking, which I also did, of course. Got a couple of drinks, and you go to that same old place, but smoking the good stuff, and you're up in your fucking way-out-osphere. The great red hash was hard to come by, as were Thai sticks and Nepalese temple balls, real round ones. It had such a sticky, resiny, sweet, tangy taste. It's a real dream-inducing high. People would tell you it was laced with opium, but why would anyone lace a common drug like hash with something as expensive and rare as opium? Another urban legend gone wild. Not too different from the one where the girl supposedly fucked herself to death on the gear shift knob. That one we wanted to believe. My mom used to ask me, if you're already on such a high from finally having made it, why do you need to get any higher? But I did anyway. When you grow up doing drugs, chances are you're going to spend the rest of your life doing drugs. They were never to put out the paint. I would drop acid and run up the hill to the ski lodge. I'd drop and go to Bashbish Falls, upstate New York, and stay in the woods all day. I would drop acid and go from Friday to Sunday night tripping on the aqueduct, riding my mini bike with Tommy Tabano, Ray's brother, who just passed away last year. Bless his heart. He was a big part of my yesterday. So we were all off and running, all in bed with the same girl, Mary Jane. I was good on stage, so why not be high, too? I was already addicted to adrenaline, so why not get higher, as Sly Stone preached? Using in spite of adverse consequences. Certain things happened in this band that weren't drug-induced, although there haven't been many. I've always felt that we couldn't take one step forward without two or three back. But let me don the devil's drug advocate hat for a minute. A socio-cultural rant, if you will. Why are drugs eternally attached to unpleasant hippie references? For those who OD'd, drugs are bad, yes, but some of us could do them. Great seekers, writers like Carlos Castaneda and Aldous Huxley, did they take trips, like I did, up the side of a mountain to a ski lodge in the summer just to smell the wildflowers and watch the foxes run and stare as the clouds hypnotically floated by? Are all drugs bad just because some of them took over my life from time to time? I wrote some beautiful songs under the influence, just as Jimson Weed inspired Carlos Castaneda when he was writing his Don Juan iconic novels. By the way, I was getting the cues when I was 8 years old. Sinatra's Come Fly With Me. Even then, I didn't interpret those lyrics as come fly with me on a big old jet airliner. It was metaphorical. And guess what? A lot of us kids back then picked up on those things. Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, Alice in Wonderland. If anyone has ever tripped on acid, in their heart of hearts and mind of minds, they have experienced what it's like to truly fall down the rabbit hole. And when the drugs hit full on, you are in Wonderland. Life is something to be reckoned with. Winter has to be reckoned with. For the cold, find something warm. Baby's birthing, a shot of Jack Daniels to celebrate, wine, Christ's blood. But to me, it's always been euphoric. Why? Euphoric recall isn't just drug-based. It's thinking back to your childhood and the best memories of those times. That's euphoric recall. It's wonderful. Aerosmith did drugs. Drugs, drugs, and more drugs. Can it take you down? Yes. Did it take me, us, down? Well, we're still here. But it's also what life is all about. Watching whales breach, holding a baby bunny, getting a new puppy for Christmas, that feeling of great. It's all humans really want. They say in every moment you have a choice to make between fear and love. I believe that. But all we really need at the end of the long and winding day is to be petted, to climax, to make love, and to be happy. And that is euphoric, with or without the hash coffin. By the time we were getting ready to make the second album, we all flew solo. We didn't share drugs anymore. Everyone had his own godlike, capable of anything we put our minds to attitude. We stormtrooped across America, 3 shows in a row, meet and greets every night. where the band quick chats and shakes hands with fans who've managed an after-show pass thanks to a local radio station promotion, doing TV and radio interviews in every town we passed through. It was around this time that things started to get seriously out of control, but no one noticed because we were having too much fun. In the beginning, drugs seemed positively essential. We had to get high to get by, because no human had that kind of unworldly stamina and enthusiasm. When it came time to start recording our second album, Get Your Wings, in 1973, Bob Ezrin, Alice Cooper's producer, was going to be our producer, which meant we were now in the big leagues, as the title of the album implied. So we were about to get ours. Then Bob Ezrin came and saw the band and wrote, "They're not ready." I saw the note. I've got it somewhere. I take it out every once in a while and look at it, and a little steam comes out of my ears. But Jack Douglas, who was then Ezrin's assistant, also saw us and loved the band. He told Ezrin we were the long-foretold great American band. Jack Douglas, a fucking visionary. So Ezrin said, "Well, Jack, you want to do them, you do them." That's how Jack Douglas got the job. Us. Isn't that great? Naturally, we were a little resentful at first when we met Jack. I was thinking, Ezrin doesn't think we're ready. Well, fuck you guys. I knew we were, because I knew what we had. Actually, who knew back then, right? But when you win in the end, you can always go, "You know, I knew." We relied on the drugs for recording, touring, partying, fucking, anything at all, really. But we already knew there was a dark side to all this, as in the lyrics to Same Old Song and Dance. "Got you with the cocaine they found with your gun. No smoothie-faced lawyer to get you undone. Say love ain't the same on the south side of town. You could look, but you ain't gonna find it around. It's the same old story, same old song and dance, my friend. It's the same old story, same old story, same old song and dance. Fate comes a-knocking, doors start locking. Your old-time connection, change your direction. Ain't gonna change it, can't rearrange it. Can't stand the pain when it's all the same to you, my friend." Seasons of Wither was a song that had been germinating in my head for a long time, since those lonely nights in Sunapee in the winter of 69. It came from fears I had walking along the road alone on dark nights up in Sunapee. But the other, more sinister tracks, like Lord of the Thighs, came from the seedy area where we recorded the album. Lord of the Thighs was about a pimp and the wild life out on the street. Get Your Wings came out in 1974 and got us a couple of hits on rock radio. Same Old Song and Dance, and Train Kept a Rollin', and was back on the road again. I love going out on that stage. You come out of your dressing room, head down that gray cinder block corridor with bodyguards and road managers flanking you, up a ramp, onto the stage, and there you are. 25,000 Blue Army Aerosmith faithful out there waiting for you to light the fuse. It's a high that I'm not sure ever goes away. After some doot-da-doot started waving that 45 round during a Ted Nugent set, the threat of some moron taking a shot had me worried I'd be next. But if I keep moving, no way they can hit me. That's when I adopted a Tigger mentality, and I've been dancing my ass off ever since. Ray Davies knew how to work a stage. The Kinks are the most underrated band of the 60s British rock invasion, and to this day, everyone knows who they are. Never mind the Bible, that one song, "You Really Got Me," it was the Bible. Oh my God, it was the shit. And then they were smart enough to follow it up with "All Day and All the Night," which was "You Really Got Me" on steroids. You know why they sang it like that? Shel Talmy, their producer, thought that Ray Davies couldn't sing. So he told him to blurt it out in short little telegraphic outbursts. That way you don't have to sing the melody. Fucking genius, because every word hammers at you. Every word is percussion in that song. I love that. If you can't think, don't speak in long sentences. And if you can't sing, don't try to carry a long melody. But of course, the Kinks did all these other things too. What a ballad. Waterloo Sunset. Then they went off into all those crazy operas and concept records. Lola versus the Power Man and the Money Go Round, Part 1. Preservation, Act 1, and Preservation, Act 2. 100-amp fuse-blowing arena rock. Shit happens between bands on the road. We played a show one time at Harrisburg Arena in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. It was one of those places where they usually sell horses and cattle, so the place stunk of manure. And Queen would not go on because we were the headliners. They refused to open for us, and the show was canceled. Another time, we were opening for Bachman Turner Overdrive, and they sabotaged the scrim that would fly the Aerosmith wings. The roadies rigged the cables holding up the flag of the Blue Army so that when Kelly pulled on them, the fucking pipe bent and the wings crashed. We learned that the best way to beat sabotage on the road was to just kick ass every night, and that's just what we did. Marco Hudson told me a great story about David Coverdale when Whitesnake was opening for Ozzy Osbourne. Coverdale supposedly showed up at the venue on more than one occasion with a pair of hookers wearing white fur coats and toting two Afghan dogs. Ozzy hated it. He called him a prat. The crew was instructed to lay down silver duct tape that would lead Coverdale to his dressing room. One night, before Sir David arrived, Ozzy took the tape up himself and redirected the trail to the boiler room. We were playing in Lincoln, Nebraska one time. That's where Joey and I got busted for throwing firecrackers out the window of a Holiday Inn. The bill was Aerosmith, Kansas, and the Elvin Bishop Group. Elvin Bishop had that hit single, I Fooled Around and Fell in Love. Crazy Raymond, or Ray Gourmet, as we called him at the time, had it in our contract rider that we had to have a turkey on the bone dinner every fucking night backstage after the show. Not turkey loaf, not turkey roll, not pressed turkey, but a fresh fucking turkey on the bone dinner. Even though we never ate it because everybody was so out there all the time and just wanted to get out of the venue and back to the hotel. 9 out of 10 shows, we'd get turkey roll with bubbles in the meat or some mystery meat that looked like hockey pucks and tasted like a fry boot. And that's just what we got in Lincoln. I lost it. We gave the stuff to Kansas. They ate it and loved it. I guess that futuristic meat was one of the reasons why they were a great prog band. Speaking of meat, I found out years later, through a crew member confessional, that when the techs would get pissed off at the band, they'd wipe their ass with a bologna and put it back on the deli tray. Come to think of it, I always thought the bologna on tour had an anal tinge. Being on tour with Jeff Beck was one of the highlights of my career. One time we were performing in Chicago at Comiskey Park, and Jeff Beck came out and played Train Kept a Rollin' with us. It was incredible. Then the stage manager comes running right out on stage and yells, "You're burning the building down!" We thought he meant that the band was on fire. Joe and Brad have been known to rip some pretty hot leads. But the building was really burning. The asphalt and tar on the roof caught fire and the place was going up in flames. That night, we burned the house down. Twice. We always knew that our old manager, Frank Connolly, was hooked up with some shady characters, but now Frank's old business partners were coming home to roost. A big boxing promoter, we'll call him Tony Maruca, claimed he wasn't getting his share and came to collect. "Frank told me I'd be taken care of," he said. "I'll break fucking Steven Tyler's legs if you don't do right by me." David Krebs went into the Celtics dressing room with Maruca, and there was a powwow. Krebs took care of it by laying some dead presidents on it. I had no idea this was going on, one of those rare transactions where I was glad to be out of the loop. January 1975. In the midst of a spine-chilling, ball-freezing New York winter, we began work on our third album, Toys in the Attic. I came up with the title because of its obvious meanings, and since people thought we were fucking crazy anyway, what did it matter? I wasn't hip to the 1960 Tony Award-nominated Broadway play of the same name, or its 1963 Oscar-nominated film adaptation. Didn't matter if I had been. This was Aerosmith's Toys in the Attic. Singular, sexy, and psycho-sensational. My creative chi ebbed and flowed from tongue and puss to tongue and cheek. I've always been tactile and oral. Maybe too much love for my mother? But it became obvious to me in later years that the passion I had was unlike that of other males, and unfortunately, on various occasions, that passion wasn't shared by other members of the band. I've been misquoted as saying that I'm more female than male. Let me set the record straight. It's more half and half, and I love the fact that my feelings are akin with puella eternis, Latin for the eternal girl. What better to be like than the stronger of the species? I mean, women are the superior beings, are they not? Sure, the male brings the food home, but can they birth children and feed them from their breast? Woman has compassion, which man lacks. I feel I was born with those same feminine compassions. People wind up stashing their memories in the attic, a traditionally nostalgic place. Your old teddy bear, Archie comic books, Slinkies, family heirlooms, a favorite moth-eaten sweater, photos of childhood, your old roller skates, tickets to a Stones concert, Mia's crib. The other reason I came up with toys in the attic was that I knew we'd made it. I was the kid who put my initials in the rock because I wanted the aliens to know I was there. It's a statement of longevity. The record will be played long after you're dead. Our records would be up there in the attic too, with the things that you loved and never want to forget. And to me, Aerosmith was becoming that. I knew how the Beatles, the Animals, and the Kinks did it, with lyrics and titles. I saw reason and rhyme in all the lunacy that we were concocting. Leaving the things that are real behind. Leaving the things that you loved remind. All the things that you learned from fears. Nothing is left but the years. Joe was jamming a riff and I started yelling, "Toys! Toys! Toys!" Organic, immediate, infectious, fucking amazing. Once again, the toxic twins ride off into the sunset. This time, the sunset of the attic. Joe's been my inspiration on more songs than I would ever tell him. Sometimes just his presence in the room is enough to inspire lyrics to the greatest melody. It's proved itself on every record we've ever done. I'm friends with some of the best, but I'm partners with almost none. He is so much more than the real thing. Coke has nothing on Joe Perry. Like leaves on an artichoke, the more layers you peel off, the closer you get to the heart. Guitar players jam. Toys, toys, toys. In the attic. I just started singing and it fit like chocolate and peanut butter. Joe plays his ass off on that song. He used to sprawl across the couch with the TV on and play guitar at the same time. I'd come in and say, "What are you doing?" And he'd say, "I'm just watching TV." "No, you're not. You're writing a song," I'd fire back. And all I could say is, "Thank you, Thomas Edison, for inventing the tape recorder." Joe played stuff unconsciously. It didn't matter what key or tempo. That came later. Just playing. Just feeling. Just being Joe fucking Perry. Tom Hamilton, same thing. He's come up with these slippery, slimy, melodically delicious, out-of-the-blue bass lines from practice. He'd play stuff so down and dirty just from warming up, and it would turn into a song. Like Uncle Salty, actually written on his guitar. Movie stars want to be rock stars. Guitar players want to be lead singers. Bass players want to be guitar players. Now she's doing Annie for money and a penny. A sailor with a penny or two or three. Hers is the cunning for men who come a-running. They all come for fun, and it seems to me that when she cried at night, no one came. And when she cried at night, went insane. Here I was thinking about an orphanage when I wrote those lyrics. I'd try and make the melody weep from the sadness felt when a child is abandoned. I pretended to know the headmaster, to get inside his head, and what I heard was, "Uncle Salty told me stories of a lonely baby with a lonely kind of life to lead. Her mammy was lusted, daddy he was busted, they left her to be trusted till the orphan bleeds." Inside was hell, or barely tolerable, but she sang, "It's a sunny day outside my window," because I'm a sucker for a happy ending. The song title, Walk This Way, came from the Mel Brooks film Young Frankenstein, secondhand. Jack Douglas was discussing how Marty Feldman's scene went, where he utters the now immortal line. It was hilarious, and it stuck. I'd actually finished the song the night before our recording session and kept it in a bag that had all the other lyrics I'd written for the Attic LP. Arriving that day at the studio at 4 p.m., I got out of the cab and realized that I'd left the bag in the car. Gone. 2 hours later, I went upstairs. I sat down on the steps with my pen and wrote the words to Walk This Way on the wall. As I rewrote each line, the words all came back to me. never saw the bag again. Backstroke lover always hide beneath the covers, till I talk to your daddy, he say. He said you ain't seen nothing till you're down on a muffin, then you're sure to be changing your ways. I met a cheerleader, was a real young bleeder, oh, the times I could reminisce. Cause the best things of loving with her sister and a cousin only started with a little kiss, like this. Walk this way. Toys in the Attic came out in April 1975 and went gold. The rest of the year we spent on the road. This was the year it all changed for us. The album got good reviews and people started taking us more seriously. About fucking time. We toured with Rod Stewart and Ted Nugent. Ted is the definitive Paul Bunyan with an SG guitar, a man's man. His music is in tune with the times, but his values are as old-fashioned as Davy Crockett's coonskin cap. He's so far to the right, he runs over his left, and if looks could kill, his wife would slay us all. Tour managers had it good back then. We didn't know it, but every person they let in the back door, they got a gram of blow from. You want to come in? Cost you a gram, man. Ounce of coke. An ounce of coke will get you up close and personal. Yup, I'll give you all the tickets you want, but make sure you got an ounce. And dude, it's got to be just like that last shipment. The Aerosmith crew were ruthless extorters of blow. I met these guys later on. We'd go back to the same cities 10 more times, and they would all come out of the woodwork and go, you know, when I used to come here, Kelly would charge me in coke. Last time I saw you, it cost me a fucking 8-ball just to get me in. First it was a gram, then it went up. Even among hustlers and dope fiends, there's inflation. And that's what they did. That's why Jimmy, Kelly, whoever, were nowhere to be found. And the more famous a band got, the more blow. And who did we buy our blow from? Kelly. We drank a lot because of the blow, and we got blown a lot because we drank a lot. My favorite cocktail was a rusty nail. Drambuie mixed with the finest scotch and a twist of lemon. I found out later on that Eric Clapton and Ringo Starr were fellow rusty nailers. It's a good thing we set that glass down, or it would have been the rusty nail in all our coffins. Kelly had a monstrous appetite for coke, and I say that from the point of view of one who had a pretty ferocious appetite himself. He was a human vacuum cleaner. Fort Wayne, Indiana, we got into town and the crew would introduce the infamous Kelly to the local stagehands. Listen, sons. Kelly could snort a week's worth of their blow a foot from the baggie through midair. The guy would go, what the fuck, man? And Kelly would look at me and go, ah, coke etiquette, Jack. He had so much residue in his nostrils, he made it into Ripley's Believe It or Snot. I once owned a Cessna Riley conversion turbo, bought it in New Hampshire, twin-engine turboprop, safest plane in the air. My friend Zunk would fly it with his father. I'd be at the house and call him up. Let's go flying, Zunk. And I'd swing over, pick up a gram, and we'd go up and do parabolics, where we'd pretend to go up and around and over a clock. 10, 11, 12. Woo-wee. 1, 2, 3. And between 11, 12, 1, 2, and 3, you are truly weightless. There's nothing on the planet Earth like this. You can simulate it, but up there, flying around the clock, that's the real deal. So one day, our flight was canceled, and the band had to get to Indiana. We're flying from New Hampshire, just me, Zunk, and Joey. Zunk wants to show off for Joey, so he goes into a parabolic. And I've got an ice chest in there. The ice chest goes up in the air, and it's hovering in front of Joey's face. What the fuck? He's freaking out. But even better, another time, we're on the band plane, and we happen to hit some nasty turbulence. I whip out my vial of coke, put a line on my thumb, grab a straw, and start to snort. Just then, the blow begins to float up in the air, hovering like fairy dust in front of my face. I shove the straw up my nose and sniff the powder right out of the air. A gram of coke floated out of my bindle and into the air. I was known from then on as the human dustbuster, which turned into dirt devil, which turned into demon of screaming. And then at one point, the demon of semen, but that's another chapter. For a while, we had a guy in the crew who was an ex-cop. Having worn a badge himself, he'd get friendly with the local cops in the towns we played, hang out with them, and they'd give us the stuff that they'd taken off the kids. Fucking cops in uniform. They'd say, put your hands out. And they'd put bags of weed and little dime bags of whatever in tinfoil in them. He could also buy guns from various people. So one time he goes, come here, and pulls the bay down from the bottom of the bus. I look inside, and there's what I thought was an AR-16 and this shotgun with a huge clip. The clip was round. I'd never seen anything like it. You can't even get one anymore. It's known now as a weapon of mass destruction. I took the AR-16 up to Henry's house, went into his backyard, loaded it up, and said, you know, this doesn't look right. I walked into his woods, pulled the trigger, and it went brrrr. I had never shot a machine gun up till that point. I freaked. Then I ran back to Henry's house, rolled it up in a blanket, went back to my house, took my boat out to the middle of Lake Sunapee, and threw it in the water. Rambo, I am not. Whenever we wanted to snort blow together backstage, we'd say, let's go have a production meeting, and disappear into some little room and pack our beaks. There wasn't anything subtle about it. It was like, production meeting. We'd take over an office and have a cop stand guard for us outside. We called it the money room. We were all gacked to the gills back then. Gacked is when you've done too much blow and your jaw starts moving like a robot. There's white on the side of your lips. You're babbling, speaking in tongues, rattling on about nothing. Doesn't matter what it is. You get to the end of some insane rant and go, wait a minute, did I just say that? That was the norm back then. You're so stoned and speeding, thinking about what to say while the other person's speaking. You're just gacked. That's the best part. The worst part is, nothing's funny. You could make a joke like, what's the difference between pink and purple? Your grip. And the room would look like an oil painting. Not a laugh. And then you think you're the phallic mentor on this shit. But when it comes to doing the deed, it's like pushing a rope uphill or stuffing an oyster in a slot machine. Drugs were already getting to be a problem on stage and off, but it was a problem we wanted, and there were plenty of people to help us go down the road to perdition. Sometime along the way, we'd met this character, Brimstone. What a perfect name for a dealer. We were playing the old Michigan Palace in April of 74. One of the roadies says to Raymond, someone wants to talk to you. And there he was, the devil himself. Brimstone was 5'4", big curly hair, big lips. He pulls out a bag filled with drugs. Raymond tells him, here's the deal. Party afterward. If you want to come, it'll cost you an 8-ball to get in the door. Walk in the room, don't say a word, take the shit out, put it on the table, then we'll talk. With that, he became the band's regular dealer. He traveled with us, followed the tour with his own money. As we made more and more bread, we bought bigger and bigger amounts, until eventually we gave him $20,000 for a pound of coke. 2 o'clock in the morning, there'd be Brimstone. Always had 2 6-foot blondes with him. Came to a bad end. Brimstone became Tombstone. In fond memory, I will say this. That man knew more about R&B than Joe and I put together. He'd sit on the floor with us like the Beatles did with the Maharishi, talking about music. As in the rest of my life, there are no coincidences. I feel blessed for knowing him. Eccentric characters always found us. We're playing the Cow Palace in San Francisco in 93. Night before the show, we're invited down to the O'Farrell Theater, the infamous sex club owned by the Mitchell brothers. Rolling Stone writer Hunter S. Thompson is in Command Central, the office upstairs with a pool table.
Steven, come here, he shouts. I want you to see this.
He proceeds to introduce me to 2 blondes that were, no shit, 11s out of 10. The first girl has her lip pierced with a 4-foot chain hanging from it that's connected to the other girl's pierced clit. Right through the poor thing. Couldn't you have done that after I got to it? I said. How are you going to feel my mouth? The question was, at best, rhetorical. Oh, I will, she smiled. They climbed on top of the billiard table, and we commenced to play. Gave new meaning to the term pocket pool, left ball in the side pocket. When the drum riser starts harmonizing, you know you are either too high or some mystic Pythagorean force is at work. After the band stopped playing, the sound waves from the stage would vibrate the drum riser, and out would come this perfect note, a booming E-flat. It was wild. What was that? The stage was haunted. The note would come out through the holes we'd cut into its side so that we could move it. It was feedback, but it was freaky, especially on a few lines of bloat. Hear this otherworldly foghorn sound emanating from it. Like I said earlier, I was a drummer, so I'd share all my tricks with Joey. Back when I was with Chain Reaction and no one could hear me, I put a pillow in my drum, ripped the front head off, placed a Shure 58 mic in there, and hooked that into two Colossus amps. I put them on either side of my drums when I played, which pissed off Don Solomon no end, but he knew it accentuated what he was playing. I told Joey that story later on, so he, having to outdo me, got a 12-inch speaker that someone built for him that he stuck behind his head to enhance our show. It would get mic'd for sound, the bass would get mic'd for slap, and we were off and running. One day I look at Joey and I hear the stage talking to me, humming this note. Little did I know it was his fucking bass amp feeding back. Joey's a good drummer, but I'm the one that showed him foot, 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 hi-hat, hi-hat, foot and hi-hat playing the same thing, snare in the middle. He fucking practiced that and he got it. I showed Joey the egg on my foot. The egg is the muscle you get on your foot from playing the foot pedal. I showed him because I was so proud of it. He looked at me, and I could see in his eyes that he loved the whole thing, the romance of it. Joey became one of the greatest drummers ever, which made him 2 feet taller than he was when he started. Now he's taller than me, but he still wears spandex with a little teeny nub. You've no doubt heard the expression, "I know it's small, but it's fat like a beer can." Most men dress to the left or the right. Joey dresses straight out. Far as endowments go on the other members of the band, two are hung like a Sopwith camel, one's got a licorice nib, and one has a big 10-inch. I won't say who that is, but his first name is Steven. Joey was one of the reasons why I wrote the song Big 10-inch Record. I guess it was always wishful thinking. And when it comes to rumors, while we're on the subject of phallic nobility, here's one more. I've come to find out, as the years roll by, that everybody seems to think that in the middle of Big 10-inch Record, I say, "Suck on my big 10-inch." I can't tell you how many people I've heard this from. Engineers, producers, disc jockeys, and of course, fans from all over the world. Well, I hate to burst your bubble, but the song is about a big 10-inch record. And in the middle, I say, "Sept," like except for my big 10-inch. How do you get "suck on" from "sep for"? Again, wishful thinking. BJ, a.k.a. Billy Joe Reich, who was one of the crew in the 70s, used to make jokes on the backstage passes. He'd print them up in the dressing room and laminate them, like "this backstage pass authorized by Mondo" or "death by Valium," with a drawing of Kelly crucified on Joe's amp stack. There's an old blue Aerosmith backstage pass somewhere showing me pissing on it. I kept my medicine cabinet on stage in a 14-inch drum head, the bottom of which contained Jack Daniels and two Dixie cups. One Dixie cup with a straw and blow in it, and the other with Coca-Cola and Jack Daniels. From behind the amps, I'd put the towel over my head and put my nose over it. The straw would be sticking out of the cup as if it were a drink. I wanted an on-stage dressing room where I could snort drugs. The idea was a small, movable sentry box that we could put at the back of the stage. The towel over my head routine was starting to get risky and a bit obvious, so sometime in 76, we ordered a small dressing room from Tom Fields and Associates, a theatrical lighting company that also builds sets. We gave them the plans and the size, 36 inches deep by 36 inches wide and 6 feet tall. But when it showed up, it was 36 feet by 36 feet. They called it Mondo's Condo. It was such a monstrous-sized fucker, it showed up on a huge flatbed truck. It was like the Stonehenge prop in Spinal Tap, only in reverse. We sent it back. We wrote on it, "Sell it to the Stones." And I think they did. Joe had vials of Coke with straws in them at the back of the stage, and when the lights would go out, he'd go over there like he was checking something or making a guitar change, and Kelly would put the straw in his nose. He'd take a hit, then the lights would come on again. The Coke binging got so bad and blatant to where we just laid out lines on top of the bass amps on the left side of the stage. One of the things we always put in our riders was that the promoter had to provide in the dressing room a full-length 6-foot-long mirror. I would take the local promoter's rep into the dressing room and he'd say, "Well, there's the 6-foot mirror you requested, Steven." And I'd say, I can see the mirror all right, but where the fuck's the 3-foot razor blade? The crew used to strew the stage with bizarre, arousing, and strange objects to startle, amuse, and titillate the band. For a while, they put a scale model of the Starship Enterprise on stage and moved it around. Elsewhere, they'd scatter Polaroids of naked girls from the night before across the floor. And then there was the pièce de résistance, Nick Spiegel's artificial vagina. Nick Spiegel was an aerotech, and we made fun of him when we first caught him playing with a latex pocket pussy. Kelly decided to get him a deluxe model. He went to this porn store, waited until nobody was around, and pointed to this top-of-the-line artificial vagina, a realistic-looking latex rubber job with a receptacle inside and some plastic pubic hair on the outside. It looked like they'd taken the sweepings off the barbershop floor and glued them on with super glue. But this was definitely the item, so Kelly said, "Let me see that one." "Will that be all?" the clerk asked. "That's okay, just wrap it up." So on the way out, the guy's going, "Oh, have a nice night, sir." And Kelly says, "Oh, it's not for me." Unlike the other bands I'd been in, with Aerosmith, the band members were willing to go the distance. The thought that we might not make it never occurred to any of us. When a band has doubts or thoughts that they have other options and tell themselves they can become accountants or realtors and carpenters and whatnot, they're going to fail. And when the guys in those bands give up, they become bitter. They're all school teachers and cops on fucking meds. I think this is a good time to address a matter of great political and social import, that being the scaly truth about LSD. No, the other LSD, otherwise known as lead singer disease. Jimmy Page allegedly coined the term in less than endearing homage to his raspy-throated frontman. LSD is a not-much-talked-about syndrome defined in the Mondo Manual of Psychiatric Disorders as bone-gnawing, spleen-curdling jealousy of the lead singer in a rock band on the part of other members of the band, erupting in violent blaspheming and tantrums by such members whenever the lead singer's image appears on the cover of popular magazines. Being the lead singer of a successful band, there's jealousy up the wazoo, and my big mouth just makes it worse. I'll just come right out and say shit that people would never utter on their own because they'd either get fired or they weren't asshole enough to do it. I'm definitely known for not being the shrewdest fox in the forest. Jealousy, animosity. The lead singer is the dancing bear, the cash cow, and sometimes it's hard for band members to handle. They know that there's no getting by without the frontman. They sure have had fun making fun, but every time they point a finger at me, there's three of them fingers pointed right back at them. As Terrible Ted says, they can roast marshmallows out of the flames of my ass, as long as they share them with me. Musical s'mores, a rectal delicacy. And what about the LI3? That's how Tom, Brad, and Joey refer to themselves in a Rolling Stone article. Initials proudly standing for the least interesting three. Well, let's go there for a moment. Take Tom Hamilton, for instance. 3 years ago, we're on tour, and one night I go, "Tom, it's been 30 fucking years. Have you ever talked into a mic?" The answer was a resounding never. "Don't you think you should break the silence? Just go over and say anything. I'll introduce you. Just do it so you can say you did." And he did it. And never mind the night I took a black marker and went behind Tom and outlined his fucking shoes. And when he came to the front of the stage, I said, "Guess where you've been standing for the last 30 minutes? And he fires back, "Where?" So I point to the floor. There. And Tom, like his legendary predecessors, Bill Wyman and John Entwistle, never moved from his spot. Like a stoic still life. But he did move 20,000 fans that night with his magical intro to Sweet E, or what he could do to a fretless bass and Hole in My Soul. I live on the tail of a comet, and I must admit that with all the me that's me, I know in my heart of hearts that I would not be here if it weren't for those around me. They called themselves the LI3, I didn't. I took a risk and decided to be the poster boy. The magnet for other people's fears, doubts, and insecurities. It's all part of a delicious statement that all those people in my life do have something to say about me, but they aren't me, And they don't know where I've been, or what it took to get to that nasty, mean, maniacal behavioral place that everybody hates. When you're in a band, fans are always giving you presents, yeah? At customs, when the gent in the uniform says, "Sir, there seems to be a packet of tinfoil in your luggage containing a contraband substance, and we'll have to throw you into one of our dungeons for 99 years," you could say, "What's this, then? Never touched that stuff in my life." "Oh, one of our overzealous fans must have put it there." That's how we transported our rocket fuel. Throw a half ounce of Coke in an envelope, and on the outside, write in big, scrawling Crayola crayon letters, "You are the shit. Aerosmith fucking rules. This is just a token of my affection. Signed, Dwayne." And slip it in the drum kit. How we do love our fans. Chapter 8. Ladies and genitals, I'm not a bad guy. I'm just egotistical. John Cryer. I just want to say I'm a huge fan. I lost my virginity to you. Steven. Really? Well, you know, there's a lot of the 70s I don't remember. From 2 1/2 Men, Season 4, Episode 2. Wow, it's funny. You look back now, and the New York Dolls had that reputation for being over the top. Sure, the Dolls were in the Way Outosphere, but we were in our own orbit. My mind was on the dark side of the moon, as Clapton said in his Bangladesh documentary. But back then, everyone in the rock elite was living on the edge, and right out of Zap Comics, except for Zappa, who may have had one foot in the Way Outosphere, but the other was firmly planted up the ass of the Carl Sagan School of Reality. I spoke to Frank once on the phone, having heard he was sober. Talk was, he'd take out a whole floor of rooms for those on his crew who shared his passion. "What the fuck are you talking about, Steven?" he said. "I don't have a problem with drugs. I've never done drugs." "What?" I said, flabbergasted. "But seriously," I said, "you've never even smoked pot?" An emphatic no followed. Who would have ever thunk that the mother of invention had no intention of dancing with Leary, swapping spit with Keezy, or, if ever, however I'm hearing, he never, ever, made sweet love to Don Juan, the Yaqui warrior of the Peyote Button tribe, then how the fuck did he ever write Overnight Sensation or Weasels Rip My Flesh? This was a wake-up call to a guy whose Alice B. Toklas imagination sprouted from the same soil as the trippin' troubadours of the 60s. I thought he was one of us, lost, the damned, the terminally unique ones. He was. He just didn't use. But why was it so wrong for me to think that Zappa wrote such euphoric musical prose and that it wasn't based on some euphoric narcotic substance that might have helped get him there? And even if he never took a drug, in the literal snort, puff, or swallow sense, he felt love. Love is a drug. I knew that even before Brian Ferry told me. Frank felt pain and anguish and sadness, and those are drugs of sorts. In fact, when you get scared out of your mind, your body releases drugs, endorphins and adrenaline, and just look at the molecular structure of adrenaline. It's about 4 notches away from what cocaine's made of. Endorphins, 4 notches from heroin. This was a new truth for me. Frank was only high on music. Is it Lao Tzu's belief that it's not the walls, but the space between the walls that defines the room? Wow. Or my belief that it's not the notes, but the space between the notes that defines the song? In 1975, the year Toys in the Attic came out, we played with the Dolls at Max's Kansas City. I knew something was going on when we were received at Max's like Broadway Joe at the Super Bowl. There was so much magic in the air, Lou Reed looked like Houdini. Aerosmith and the New York Dolls. It was the perfect marriage. David was me on steroids and 9-inch heels. The Dolls were OTT over the top. What I took from Johansson was his flamboyance and a wise mouthful of sass, but don't give me no lip. I got enough of my own. I never wanted to wear lipstick on stage or high heels. Maybe I should have worn heels. My feet wouldn't have gotten so fucked up because I couldn't have moved around as much. I loved playing with the dolls and the wow factor they possessed, the punch, the titles of their songs. But I thought that there were more toys in our attic. They would flame out magnificently while we were still setting a fire. When you're a teenager, masturbation is more about doing it fast and not getting caught, and less about doing it right and making it last. Later on, I'd come to find out that the best thing about masturbation is that you didn't have to look your best. The dolls were wearing glam to the nines. That described the smoky din of Max's on any given night. It was musical socialism. There was no formal headliner. The bathroom was full of blow, and the lineup of bands was whoever got their line first got to go on stage. Aerosmith, the Dolls, and Wayne County, and oh yeah, those fucking chickpeas they put on every table. They were more of a weapon than an appetizer. Wayne would have a toilet on stage where he'd reach down and grab a handful of dog food from the bowl between his legs and rub it all over himself like he was smearing his body with shit. We only played for one thing back then, and we all played for the same reason. We came to fly our freak flags. I called it Veni, Vidi, Vici, Veni Redux. Latin for, we came, we saw, we conquered, and we came again. I'd get so hammered when I hung out with the dolls. Johnny Thunders, who was one of the guitar players, used to go out with a twin named Lisa, whose sister, Teresa, was very sweet. She and I dated long enough to eventually marry and have two beautiful children. Twins again. Ain't it funny? Johnny Thunders was so out there. His addictions took him to graffitiing the ceilings of his hotel bathrooms with his own blood. His girlfriend had stories about walking into hotel bathrooms and seeing his initials on the ceiling. I call that dancing with the devil. He's died since, as have quite a few members of the band. They were hell-bent on self-destruction. Unlike the dolls, we came up for air once in a while. At least early on. It took us a few more years to implode, but even then, we kept on going. Music was our fuse, and drugs were the match. Like a Roman candle that would shoot out seven flaming stars, each one an album for us, we were used to living and surviving the cosmic sway. Drugs, to me, were like a black hole. I was attracted to it, and wasn't afraid to have it take me to the other side. Around this time, an unearthly creature came into my life. I first met Serinda Fox when I was cruising the streets of the Lower Village with David Johansen. She was gorgeous and glamorous, white hot with a whisper of Norma Jean, with candy floss blonde hair. She was married to and consumed by David, but devoured me with her eyes. I would sit there and watch her and wonder what the fuck is going on with these two. This insatiable fox named Serinda was best friends with Joe's wife, Alyssa, who knew exactly what was going on between us and invited her on tour with the band. While all this was going down, Serinda played lovely Lolita, and we played cat and mouse for months on and off tour. She wouldn't let me near her. You want it? Can't have it. She was interested in my rock star catnip. As the fame got more chaotic, we needed to get more organized. We used to keep all our expensive equipment in our Mr. Natural truck and leave it out on the street, which wasn't such a great idea. After a while, Ray found us a building for $40,000, and we bought it to store our equipment, record in, and turn into Mission Control. Ray ran all the merchandise and mail order and fan club stuff out of there. It was in Waltham, Massachusetts, right next to Mo Black's, and we called it the Warehouse. Raymond was always thinking ahead, perhaps sometimes with wrong head, but ahead nonetheless. On Halloween, he put a party together for the grand opening of the Warehouse and invited everybody who was anybody and anybody they knew. We set up the loading dock like a Moulin Rouge street scene, French maids waiting on tables and fishnet stockings, berets and long black cigarette holders, and an entourage that included a midget in a skunk suit claiming he was Pepe Le Pew just to piss off the party crashers. Ray's office upstairs was ground zero. In that room alone, we snorted half of Peru. The warehouse was so big you could park cars in it, which all of the band did. It was big enough to house a tractor trailer.